Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of July. Coming up on the program, the challenge for the new police minister, from policy to morale to funding. The leader of Build One South Africa on the power of accountability, liquidation versus business rescue. There is new thinking on the subject and the worsening food crisis in the Eastern Cape. Let's start with this, and the former Water Minister Senzo Mqunu is the new police minister. It's a vital portfolio given the country's soaring crime rate. He replaces the highly visible but often divisive Becky Cele. From the Institute for Security Studies, David Bruce joins me now. And David, a new minister, what do you see as the most pressing challenges facing him and the service?
Right, okay. Well, if you'll allow me, I'm going to speak on behalf of the Institute for Security Studies. So last week we released a document with a set of proposals for strengthening the SAPS. And so, you know, basically the background to that is a very strong sense that there hasn't really been any forward movement in the policing domain for a long time. To some degree, well, to a significant degree, government has relied on what you can call a kind of standard formula for responding to questions about the police. So, you know, typically the main thing that's been done is recruit more SAPS members. Then also you'll find the government talking about strengthening CPFs, things like that. But there hasn't really been any proper thinking about the kind of challenge of, you know, how to really move the SAPS as an organization forward. And so, you know, we're hoping that as Minister Mqunu will be open to kind of grappling with these questions, which are in some ways quite complex and difficult. Mm.
In your opinion, then, what would construe a different approach or more forward movement?
You know, policy is a bit of a dirty word in South Africa because we've had endless kind of policy in various, you know, government departments and so on, which is, you know, is then not implemented. Nevertheless, if you look at the Constitution, for instance, you know, a principal responsibility of the minister is to develop national policing policy. And that basically been something that's been neglected. So obviously, you can have bad policy, which would be unrealistic policy or policy which is kind of pie in the sky. But, you know, what we're arguing for is a kind of strategic approach to policy making. And so, you know, the SAPS is a very complex organization. Our experience has been, you know, in exploring the issue and where you speak to people, there are a very wide range of issues that people raise. And what we've tried to put forward is a set of what we see as critical priorities for strengthening the SAPS.
And those critical priorities would be what, and where do you think current policy deficiency lies?
Okay, well, you know, to some degree, some of the fairly predictable things. So, for instance, one area is the area of crime investigation. And so, you know, what we're calling for is some kind of audit and overall review of the functioning of the crime investigation system at the moment in order to provide a kind of firm foundation for strengthening the overall system of crime investigation. I think maybe, you know, the one thing that would illustrate the kind of difference in approach that we're calling for is that if you look at the issue of recruitment, SAPS recruitment has been based for, you know, a long time on basically the recruitment of matriculants. And so, you know, we're talking about a situation where there's many facets of policing, which are quite complex. They include certain aspects of crime investigation, providing the necessary support to police stations in terms of the analysis of data and so on. And so potentially what you need is a different kind of caliber of recruits, kind of intellectually. And so there's a, you know, one of the calls is for a kind of a whole review of the whole approach to recruitment, which is based on a greater emphasis on recruitment of graduates, recruitment of key people with specific types of skills.
David Bruce, I fully understand that policy is the main remit that the police minister has, but he's also got a job in surely fighting for more funding for the SAPS and then just generally building confidence among the public, the likes of you and me.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously the issue of resources for the police is an important issue, but our entry point is that this isn't just an issue of resources, that typically the question of resources is translated into this business of recruiting more police. And the available evidence is that that approach is not working. For instance, the biggest indicator of all is the massive drop in the detection rate for murder, which is now at something between 14% and 15%. And so, you know, and so one obviously has to move beyond an approach which is, you know, purely about fighting for more resources, as you put it. It's, you know, there needs to be kind of new thinking about what are the strategic entry points and leverage points for moving beyond the current stagnation in the policing system.
David, morale within the South African police force has been a concern for some time. What steps need to be taken to improve that?
Well, the key recommendation within, you know, set of recommendations, we have a recommendation around building a more positive and professional police identity. So it speaks to this issue of low morale and lack of public trust in the police. And intertwined with that is the issue of police corruption. You know, we'd like to move towards a situation where one sees a member of the South African Police Service. One's intuition, one's instinct is that this is a person that can be trusted. And so, you know, one of the recommendations is that a much stronger focus on the investigation of police corruption, also on strengthening the disciplinary system, particularly in its handling of allegations of serious crime against members of the SAPS. But along with that, we're talking about introducing a new framework, a new basis for building a much more positive sense of identity within the police, and talking about developing a new code of conduct for, you know, which provides a reference point for that, developing a much more positive type of identity amongst police members.
David Bruce, your analysis is always spot on, and thank you so much for joining me today. I do appreciate it.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Well, let's stay with politics and the appointment of the new executive. And one of the players in the Government of National Unity, but not part of that executive, is Build One South Africa. So how does its leader, Musi Maimane, feel? He joins me on the program now. So first of all, what do you make of the executive composition that was announced at the weekend? Is it a fair reflection, do you think, of the new political reality in the country?
Well, I think, Jeremy, let's take one step back and say, was this the only pathway we could have gone on? And I think that to try and sell South Africans on a government of national unity serves political interest. It doesn't actually serve the governance exercise. The easier path, perhaps, would have been a straightforward coalition between the ANC and DA. And yes, that might be politically difficult, but the reality of it is that that would have not only narrowed the executive yesterday, but come to a point where today we would be talking about a program of action rather than who the people are who are holding political positions. So effectively, when I look at the composition of the executive, when I wish the people well, I really do want them to succeed, but I can't help but deal with the feeling that not only is it a triumph of the ANC in that the sixth administration, they had just over 50 ministers in the executive, and now they've kept the number fairly similar. So it tells you that for them, the world hasn't changed. In essence, a party that's lost its majority has remained fairly represented in the way it would have been before. And secondly, there's no policy direction that I can certainly discern. And thirdly, you have now, a bit like choosing a Springbok national team, you are unclear which tournament you're playing, who are the loose forwards or the backliners. It doesn't make, in that sense, inspire a high level of competence in saying, I can see why that person would fulfill well in that position, because here's what we are trying to achieve. So my summation is that it is a fair compromise of politics. I'm not sure it is a fair ambition for the 60 million South Africans to say this is a leadership that will achieve the objectives they need.
Nonetheless, though, this is our lived reality as we start this long journey, and there is surely going to be a different tone. There are new voices sitting around that table. Surely that will change things in a new direction. It will open new perspectives.
It will, whether those are taken on board, given the fact that the ANC still has a significant majority. You've just literally bloated cabinet. How many more voices do you want in the room for there not to eventually become a Congress every time a decision has to be made relative to an executive that would have been smaller, more nimbler? That is part of the risky paralysis that we've entered into. But what I'm hoping that this will do is that as soon as perhaps maybe a tangible plan is put on the table, that furthermore, post the 18th of July, with all the State of the Nation address and all of that, that we really focus on building an administration that will survive any headwinds. Because this is, as much as this is a new terrain for us, it's not one unique all over the world. Globally, countries go through coalition building. But one of the things that they achieve, which is fundamental to keep the coalition going for a longer period of time, is that they are slower in appointments, faster in articulating a plan so that the bureaucracy can deal with it. So that if one day a minister or there's a squabble within one of the parties and they choose to walk or whatever the case might be, you don't feel like there must be a reset in that ministry. You can understand that the government will continue to function. And I'm anxious that at this point in time, you may run the risk of federating the government, saying, well, party X takes this portfolio, party Y takes that. They can do with it what they like. That can't be the case.
Let's talk about that plan that needs to be put on the table. South Africans essentially voted for jobs. They voted against the high cost of living. They voted for better power and no water cuts. And we remain worried about crime. The cabinet is going to be evaluated according to how it responds to those priorities. Where's the starting point there?
Well, the easiest and most strategic place to start would be that at some point or another, at least 70% of the parties that currently sit in the government of national unity at some point in their lives endorse the view of the National Development Plan. Now, the NDP is an excellent basis to start from, even though it's got ideological inferences. Parties that don't subscribe to it won't naturally be a part of it. But you can take that as a basis of a template for a plan that you can work going forward. And then post that, be able to update it for the realities of 2024 to 2029. And then say to yourself, to the very issues that correctly South Africans voted on, that the economy, education, safety, you can take lead from there. And what you then do is when you've got an articulated plan emanating from the NDP, because it's not just the political parties that endorsed it, you've also got private sector, civil society, institutions of higher learning who subscribed to the NDP. So it means that your coalescent plan can involve more sectors of society than that. And you will find that the energies of the country will respond far more positively to a coherent, future-focused vision with that plan, rather than simply responding to the political machinations.
What role do you see yourself playing, your party, and have you been offered anything?
I was very intentional at saying the first starting point is our election into parliament.
We know that being in parliament is going to be the apex of accountability. And now that no party owns a majority in parliament, actually, you can't capture parliament like you used to in the past in a one-party dominant parliament where you could vote in, if you like, mad decisions. Now what we can do is really be effective in a constructive opposition. So in my conversations with the ANC, I literally reflected on then Minister Enoch Odongwana. Even now, I said to him directly, you have an appropriations bill that you are tabling in a few weeks' time. We are going to support that and endorse it, given that it's a historical document, but some of its priorities are there. But be assured, when you do then table the budget statement in February, we are going to be very critical at looking at how constructively we can raise education, safety, the economy, so that we can build on from there. So I kind of take lead from the fact that my position that I hold is to be that constructive voice, to be the voice that's centrist in a parliament that is polarized between MK, EFF on that side of the world, and now what is this grand coalition that's established. We will have a very powerful role in being able to centralize that view, really be that voice of reason for 60 million, and then make sure that there aren't excesses, given that now the government represents 70% of the members of parliament. It could be a different form of dictatorship, if I could use such a term, but given democratically, where in fact there's a meeting of a lekgotla with this cabinet that sits elsewhere and then arrives in parliament to simply rubber stamp things. That can't be the practice anymore. So we feel that's an important role. And whatever else we could do in terms of portfolios and serving in those and chairing, we will certainly contribute, because the project of nation building isn't just an exclusive purview of the executive. It's also a very fundamental function of parliamentarians.
Musi Maimane, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
According to Stats South Africa, there was a 35% increase in liquidations this year compared to last year, and most of these were voluntarily commenced, but around 10% were placed into liquidation by compulsory applications to court. So I want to draw a distinction now between that and business rescue, and I'm in conversation with Nastasha Harduth, who's a director at Dispute Resolution. And first of all, Nastasha, let's focus on that number 35% and the increase in liquidations. It's a high number. What do you think's behind it?
Well, Jeremy, I think given the economic and political climate of South Africa generally, there is a lot of business distress. And I think that these stats essentially speak to the level of distress we are experiencing in South Africa. What concerns me is, and it's a question that's not answered by the stats, is how many of those businesses were viable but for the debts that they had to pay off. So in other words, how many of those companies could in fact have been rescued as opposed to being placed into liquidation?
In that respect, how would you determine very simply viability?
Well, it's really a case-by-case analysis, and you'd have to see whether or not the underlying business of the company, notwithstanding its debts, is a good business and one that's worth salvaging. If the business is good and there are funders that would be willing to provide post-commencement finance in order to float the company while it gets ready to pursue a business rescue, then I think it's actually a good candidate for business rescue as opposed to liquidation.
So then that leads to the next question about the main differences between business rescue and liquidation and why a company might choose one over the other.
Well, if the company, as I said, has a underlying business that's worth saving, then business rescue would obviously be the preferred vehicle through which that company could be saved, because liquidation is essentially the death knell to the company and the business. The difference really lies in this. Business rescue is a process that's legislated in the Companies Act, whereas liquidations are contained in the Insolvency Act. So the one is really to support a business, and it's a debtor-facing process where the company really collaborates through the intervention of a business rescue practitioner with all stakeholders to formulate a plan in order to rescue the company, whereas in liquidation, the company is, in terms of the Insolvency Act, placed into the hands of the liquidator, who must then realize the assets, sell them off, and distribute the proceeds to the creditors. And in that respect, liquidation is much more creditor-facing.
Notwithstanding the fact, though, that business rescue itself in recent years has come up with a lot of difficulties, it is a short history. What are those difficulties? And perhaps more importantly, Nastasha, how can they be mitigated?
Yeah, so it's a term that I don't agree with, but business rescue has been coined as being value destructive. And the reason why that is the case is that in South Africa, business rescues are companies are placed into business rescue far too late down the distress curve. In other words, not far away enough from the company's commercial insolvencies. Remembering that the legislature wanted boards of companies to at least look through the company's business in time and predict whether or not the company is going to become commercially insolvent, in other words, unable to pay its debts as and when they fall due, in the foreseeable 6 months. We see companies entering business rescue a lot later than that.
So what role then would early intervention play in the success of business rescue?
Well, it'll give the company more runway, not just runway financially, because at that stage, it should ideally still be in a position where it can wash its face at the very least, if not pay its creditors. So it'll give the company financial runway, but it'll also help to smooth relationships with stakeholders, because you'll be able to engage with them ahead of time and explain the company's situation to them. Far too often, business rescue comes as a shock to the stakeholders because it isn't spoken of until it's far too late. So it'll give a financial runway and then also a relationship runway for the company to work with in formulating the business rescue plan.
You talk about companies sometimes going too late into the process, but once they're in business rescue, they can also be in business rescue for too long. I'm thinking, for instance, of the big insurance group 360, which has been in business rescue, I think, for 2.5 years.
Yeah, that's certainly the case, and it's not something that the legislature intended. The legislature really intended that business rescue process takes no longer than 3 months. Now, that is maybe a little bit too short because a business rescue practitioner goes into a company cold. He or she needs to understand the company, become acquainted with the company's financial affairs, and also have realistic negotiations with the stakeholders. So 3 months may be too short, but years was certainly not contemplated by the legislature when they enacted the business rescue statute.
So it's bad legislation, in other words?
I don't think so. I think that business rescues can and ought to be run a lot more efficiently. I think that business rescue plans should be drafted in a way that allows a business rescue practitioner to hand over the company to the boards once the business rescue plan has been implemented. But in South Africa, because the companies enter business rescue far too late, a lot of these business rescue plans aim for a structured wind down where creditors will receive a better dividend than they would have received in a liquidation, but it still means the end of the company. They have to see that process to its end. But if the purpose is to save the company, then the plan should be drafted in such a way that the business rescue practitioners can hand it back to the board as soon as possible.
There's also been some criticism about the fee structure for business rescue practitioners and the impact of that on the quality of service provided. What needs to change in that respect, do you think?
Well, I think that early intervention here also plays a key role, because any business rescue practitioner who's worth their salt will do a pre-assessment of the company. And it goes without reason that the process will be a lot smoother and the fees will be far less if the company enters into business rescue sooner, so that there's less to be done in order to try and put the pieces back together again. So yes, the fees can be exorbitant, but I do also think that it's a function of how late in the process business rescues commenced with.
And just a final one, are there certain sectors or industries that would be better suited to business rescue over liquidation?
Absolutely. Any company that has a non-transferable license, and here we think about, for example, mining licenses, would benefit from a business rescue process. In a liquidation, those licenses would be lost. In a business rescue, those licenses will survive with the company. So that I think is a good example of where business rescue should be considered above liquidation. Also, remember that once liquidation happens, all business ceases. So if there is room to continue trading the company because you want to sell the business ultimately, then you're going to have to operate the business, and business rescue is perfect for that as well.
I am going to leave it there with my thanks. Nastasha Harder, thank you indeed. Director at Dispute Resolution. Appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this is a worrying turn of events. The South African Human Rights Commission chairperson, Chris Nissen, has urged authorities in the Eastern Cape government to implement what he terms sustainable food security programs to prevent more people from dying from hunger. I want to give you a local perspective now. I'm in conversation with Dr. Eileen Carter, who is head of the commission in the Eastern Cape. And Doctor, first of all, then, maybe just a broad overview of the current situation regarding food security in the province. Just how bad is it?
So yeah, you would note, Jeremy, I think it was last year where we issued our malnutrition report, which reflected not only in the malnutrition within the Eastern Cape, but also nationally. And it raised very big red flags. So at that stage, we did say that there needs to be a consideration that the Eastern Cape be declared a disaster area in respect of malnutrition and hunger. And in moving forward and in having reflected on also the answers that we have been given by government as well as other stakeholders, we then decided we needed to move towards a forward-looking approach. And we then hosted this Imbizo, inviting government, business and NPOs as well as tertiary institutions around the table so that we can look at the steps to be taken to move forward.
Why is the Eastern Cape so vulnerable?
You know, Jeremy, it is a national concern as well, because if you look at the 2023 General Household Survey, 14.1% of South African households ran out of money to buy food in the past year. But in the Eastern Cape, food insecurity is particularly high due to historical land disposition and underutilization of agricultural potential. But we also have a massive socioeconomic concern in terms of poverty and unemployment, which are significant barriers to achieving food security. And that is why we need to intervene quite urgently, because it's a generational concern. When children are hungry now, the effects of malnutrition on them is not going to be only felt now, it's going to be felt in the future as well.
What progress, if any, has in fact been made by the Eastern Cape government?
There has been responses to the Human Rights Commission, and we're very thankful for the Office of the Premier as well taking the lead. During the SOPA address, the Premier indicated steps being taken. Treasury was the first ones coming on board to say that they will be expressly monitoring. We've been engaging with DSD as well as rural development on a few steps that are being taken, especially as well as national DSD. But it's an urgent matter. And luckily, when we did discuss these issues recently, there was a clear indication from the relevant stakeholders that there is a rapid response team that the Office of the Premier is now going to be coordinating to address these concerns. But unfortunately, Jeremy, it's not enough. And that is why we then came to the table to say, how can we innovatively think about the solutions and take the next steps?
What would a state of disaster actually mean, the declaration thereof?
So it would mean that we can put in particular focus in the area. And also, you know, if you look at the definitions, it means that a disaster occurs when communities and the people affected can no longer come up with the solutions themselves. So it would relax a few issues. It would get funding from national, etc. But that would be almost a short-term relief. When we look at this, Jeremy, it's a holistic concern. It's something that is not new. And we need to look forward in terms of a cooperative solution, which can include a range of elements that we can put in place. So, I mean, there are policy and legislative gaps currently. There are infrastructure and resource allocations concerns as well, systemic issues. I mean, historical land dispossession continues to affect the African majority's ability to produce food, and it exacerbates food insecurity. So we need to look at this as a wholesale approach and not in an abstract manner.
Is it a problem of production, logistics and distribution, or funding, or a combination of all of it?
It's an absolute combination of all of it. There's inadequate infrastructure, such as irrigation systems and storage facilities, for example. It hampers agricultural productivity and food distribution as well. So there's also bigger issues than that, Jeremy. I mean, 30% of produced food in South Africa end up in landfill sites. So that amounts to millions of tons of wasted food annually. So there's a collective of concerns that we need to systemically address, but also we need to look at the inefficiencies in resource allocation, which sometimes, and this led the Human Rights Commission to host its inquiry, it results in unspent funds for food security being returned to Treasury. So these are all elements that we need to collaboratively address. And I do think, though, that there are solutions, not necessarily wholesale solutions, but next steps that we can take to address the scourge.
And if the current trajectory continues, what's the outlook?
Like I say, it is a generational concern. And internationally, there has been fingers pointed by, you know, special rapporteurs to say there are elements that South Africa is simply not putting in place. We are not on track to reach the SDG 2 goal that says zero hunger. So we need to look at what those recommendations were, those recommendations also, which were reflected in the Human Rights Commission's recommendations in our malnutrition report, which, for instance, is to say we need to increase the child support grant. What about a Right to Food Act, Jeremy, in terms of Section 27? You know, when we speak water, when we speak social assistance, when we speak health, we have legislation and domestic legislation on all of those, but we don't have a law of general application when it comes to food. So that would, for instance, then be able to limit a Consumer Goods Act, which sometimes plays a role in companies not wanting to donate their food. So these are all elements we have to take into consideration now, else we are going to look at a national crisis, as I've reflected already in the General Household Survey.
Dr. Eileen Carter, thank you very much indeed, the head of the South African Human Rights Commission in the Eastern Cape. And that is our program for today, MoneyWeb at Midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. As always, goodbye to you and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.